ISKCON founder, Acharya Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Ananta Koti Vaishnavinda ki jai, Namacharya Srila Haridasa Thakur ki jai, Prem Shikaho Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Dwaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaur Bhaktivinoda ki jai, Shri Shri Radha Krishna Kau Gopinath Shyama Kunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhana ki jai, Vrindavan Dhamma ki jai, Mathura Dhamma ki jai, Navadvip Mayapur Dhamma ki jai, Jagannath Puri Dhamma ki jai, Gangamaya Jumuna Devi ki jai, Bhakti Devi ki jai, Tulsi Maharani ki jai, Samaveta Bhaktivinoda ki jai, Gaur Premananda. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale. Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane Namaste Saraswati Devi. Gauravani Pacharani Nivasesa Sandhivadi Paskatyade Satarane Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Utah Parakamalam. Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha, Shri Rupam Sahirjatam Sahagana Raghunatam Vitam Samsajivam Sadvaitam Sadvaditam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Deva Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Ravita Shri Vishakam Vitam Shah Panchakapati Vistaki Vismayavita Vitanam Padamayo Vaishnavamma Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 It's Monday, the 20th of February, 2017, in Perth, Australia, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 22, The Marriage of Kardama Muni and Devahuti, Text 21. Maitreya Uvacha,
Sa
Ugradanvam Iyare Vababase,
Sa Ugradanvam Iyare
Vababase, Achit Chatushnim Aravindanabam,
Achit Chatushnim Aravindanabam,
Diyo pagrinan smita sobitena.
Diyo pagrinan smita sobitena.
Mukhena cheto lulube devahutya.
Mukhena cheto lulube devahutya.
Please check. Maitreya. The great sage Maitreya.
Uvacha.
Said. Saha.
Saha.
He Kardama.
Ugradanvan.
O great warrior Vidura. What does Ugra literally mean?
Anger.
It's terrible. So, you know, in terms of a warrior, if you're a terrible warrior, that doesn't mean you're a bad warrior, it means you're a great warrior. You understand? A horrible, inciting horror, inciting terror. Yes. It's interesting that this word is used to describe Vidura, who we normally do not think of as a terrible, aggressive warrior. We usually think of him as what?
Like devotee of the Lord.
Just a wise person. Yeah, but that's, we don't usually think of him in terms of a kshatriya varna. Isn't it? We usually think of him more as a brahmana, yeah, that he's advising the kings. But evidently he was also a very great warrior. Wow. And he's addressed this way in several places. He's addressed in terms of being a kshatriya because, you know, he's sort of considered the son of Vichitravirya. Mm-hmm. So it's... Although his father is a great Brahmin of Vyasadeva and his mother is a Shudrani. So he doesn't have any connection by birth with Kshatriya Varna.
So how did he get Kshatriya blood?
Well, he doesn't really. He doesn't really. But he's kind of this wise Kshatriya. But he evidently was also an aggressive, amazing warrior. Although I don't know of any stories of him on the battlefield. But This sort of appellation is given to Vidura at other places.
Okay. He's actually Yamaraj, isn't he?
He's yes. He is Yamaraj, but he's not being addressed here in terms of his being Yamaraj. He's being addressed here as one of the Kurus, as like the brother of Dhritarashtra and Pandu, one of the three, technical sons of Vichitravirya. So he's being addressed in that sense. But I could only see him being addressed in that sense if he actually fought sometimes. And as I said, there's other times when Vidura is addressed that way. but I don't know, or similar ways, but I don't know of any instance that describe him being on a battlefield. We'd have to assume that he did, otherwise he wouldn't be described in this way. Okay, going on. Iyat. This much. Eva. Only. Abab Basay. Spoke. Asit. Became. Cha. And. Tushnim. Silent. Aravinda Nabam. Lord Vishnu, whose navel is adorned by a lotus. Diya. By thought. Okay, so what does Diya literally mean? It's very much related to Dhyana. Meditation, so deep thought. Upagrinam, seizing. So that if you're seizing, if you're very deep meditative thought, so if we sort of there's some poetry here. It's not just that he was thinking, but it was a meditative seizing kind of thought. Smita Shobitena, beautified by his smile. Mukena, by his face. Chetaha, the mind. Lulube, was captivated. Devahutyaha, of Devahuti. So, again, what was he seizing? He was seizing Aravinda Nabam. He was seizing the meditation on he who has a navel like a lotus. Smita means to smile. Shobha means very beautiful. So he had this beautiful smile, mukena, on his face or by his face. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Sri Maitreya said, O great warrior Vidura, the sage Kardama said this much only and then became silent, thinking of his worshipful Lord Vishnu, who has a lotus on his navel. As he silently smiled, his face captured the mind of Devahuti, who began to meditate upon the great saint. So the meditation is by Devahuti, and she's called Chetaha. The mind there is called Chetaha. Chetaha also means your consciousness. So it's not the word mana. Mana is just mind. Chetaha means your consciousness. So in other words, her consciousness became absorbed. So it wasn't just a passing thought, but it was an absorption of consciousness. So Kardama Muni is absorbing his consciousness on the Lord, and Devahuti is absorbing her consciousness in Kardama. Purport. It appears that Kardama Muni was fully absorbed in Krishna consciousness because as soon as he became silent, he at once began to think of Lord Vishnu. That is the way of Krishna consciousness. Pure devotees are so absorbed in thought of Krishna that they have no other engagement, although they may seem to think or act otherwise. They are always thinking of Krishna. The smile of such a Krishna-conscious person is so attractive that simply by smiling, he wins so many admirers, disciples, and followers. Maitreya Uvacha Saugra Dhanvan Iyare Babase Aschikcha Asikcha Tushnim Aravindranabham Diyo Pagrinam Smitasho Bitena Mukena Cheto Lulube Devahutyaha. Sri Maitreya said, O great warrior Vidura, the sage Kardama said this much only, and then became silent, thinking of his worshipful Lord Vishnu, who has a lotus on his navel. As he silently smiled, his face captured the mind of Devahuti, who began to meditate upon the great sage. So he became very beautiful, Shobha. Very beautiful. So all of us would like to be beautiful. Different people have different ideas of what constitutes beauty. Some people have very peculiar mode of ignorance ideas about what constitutes beauty. And of course, beauty can be relatively understood according to the species. You know, so people find members of their own people, entities in a particular body find members of their own species beautiful. So, you know, the male and female warthogs find each other very beautiful, although to an objective observer in a higher species, we would not find them very beautiful. Or we talk about a face only a mother could love, right? So beauty is in the eye of the beholder according to one's particular mode of nature, one's particular body. But there is also an absolute standard of beauty. And, of course, that absolute standard of beauty is particularly Krishna. And if we really want to become attractive, it's not simply a matter of changing our external form. There's a multi-billion dollar industry all over the planet as to how to make your form beautiful. right? Particularly, of course, it's aimed at women whose coin of the realm is their physical beauty rather than other things. For men, their attractiveness is much more in their status and their prowess and so forth like than that, rather than just their physical form. So most of the industry for beauty and attractiveness is aimed at women, but men also want to be attractive. And there's the fashion industry, and people get, you know, men also dye their hair and get hair woven, right, when they get balding and so forth and so on. And of course, formerly, a man used to wear a lot of jewelry with the descriptions in the Shastra. A man used to wear a lot of ornaments and so forth and so on. So this desire to be beautiful is there because we, as the soul, are naturally beautiful. It's one of the qualities that we have. Unfortunately, in this body and in this world, no matter how attractive we make our material body, it's probably not going to be particularly beautiful. I mean, Devahuti was so beautiful. Of course, she wasn't a human. But she was so beautiful that she was attracting all the residents of the higher planets. But if we really want to become beautiful, we become beautiful the way Kardava Muni became beautiful, and that he became a channel for the all-beautiful. Then even in this body, even in this world, we will appear to be very attractive. That is the real way to become attractive, to become a transparent via media for the attraction of Krishna. Of course, in that, when we're in that mood, ironically, then we lose our own desire to be attractive, and we simply want to attract others to Krishna. We want to be the medium of attracting others to Krishna. And instead of feeling happy when people are attracted to us, we become happy that through us, they are attracted to Krishna. So that is what's going on here in this particular verse. So Kardava Muni, right now, he's having his attraction for Krishna be in the foreground. He has stopped speaking. He has gone into... immediately he goes into a state of meditation where he seizes, he grabs the form of the Lord. And here it's described, particularly he was meditating on the navel or the abdomen of the Lord. So any part of the form of the Lord is attractive. You know, we talk a lot about feet. I would imagine that first-time visitors to the Hare Krishna movement would wonder, what's this thing we have with feet? You know, we have paintings of feet and drawings of feet, and people wear necklaces with little silver feet on them, and we talk a lot about feet. And normally, we don't think of someone's feet as particularly attractive, generally speaking. You know, people try to dress up their feet with shoes to make their feet look particularly attractive. And you know, it used to be in China that the aristocratic women would try to make their feet attractive by making them very small. Of course, to do that, they would literally break the bones in the toes, and it became very difficult for those women to walk lifelong. But the idea was if you had really teeny, teeny, tiny feet like a child, it would be attractive. But generally, that's not a particularly attractive part of the body. But for Krishna, even his feet are very attractive. Even his toenails are very attractive. Again, we don't think, most of us, we don't think of toenails as, you know, we're not going to like stare at your, oh, Prabhu, what attractive toenails you have. You know. You put toe rings on your toes. But it's explained that Krishna's toenails are like moons. And they're so brightly effulgent that when he puts his lotus feet on a jeweled footrest, that the light from his toenails wash out all of the colors of the other jewels. They outshine all the other jewels. So even something, again, that from a material earth perspective is not particularly attractive. On the Lord, it's very attractive. And again, we don't generally meditate on somebody's belly and their navel. It's not. You know, if they're describing someone's beauty, people would say, well, you know, they have a gorgeous belly. Usually on the list, you know, I suppose if you're a belly dancer. But for Krishna, you know, his abdomen is beautiful. It has ripples in it. And this is the description in the nice song by Balabhacharya. Madharadi Pater Akilam Madhuram. And he talks about how Krishna's abdomen is very sweet. There's a nice pastime described in the Nectar Devotion, how Balaram is sleeping in Dwarka, and he starts talking in his sleep. And he starts talking in his sleep about, Krishna, you go and punish that Kaliya. And there were other people who were not sleeping, who were standing around, and they heard Balaram speak like this, and they were all enjoying it. And then Balaram somewhat woke up and yawned. And as he yawned, it says his abdomen rippled with his yawn. And then all the residents of Dwarka were very charmed by this rippling of the abdomen of Balaram. And then he went back to sleep. And, of course, we have a navel as evidence that we were in our mother's womb, and that's how we got our food and oxygen and so forth. And it was the conduit for receiving nutrition and giving out waste and receiving air. But the Lord's navel is not an indicator of him being in the womb, although he has pastimes like that. But rather, it goes the other way, that a lotus grows out of his navel, on which there is Lord Brahma, sits and creates the universe. So he creates from his navel. We are created through our navel, but he creates by his navel. So a lotus on his navel can mean this lotus of Lord Brahma, and it can also mean that his navel is as beautiful as a lotus flower. So it can be in terms of Krishna as the creator. And Kardam Muni just spoke about in his last verse, Krishna is the creator, maintainer, and destroyer. So it could very well be that he's meditating on Krishna's lotus navel that as Mahavishnu. Yakaranarna Vajalaya Bhattatisma Yoga Nidra Mananta Jagadanda Saramakupa Adhara Shakti Mavalambya Paramaswamurti. That this great form of Mahavishnu and Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, having a lotus growing. Or it could be that he's meditating on Krishna in Goloka, and his Krishna doesn't have lotuses growing out of his belly in Goloka. That's a very strange mental image I just got. But he has an abdomen that is, and a navel that is lotus-like. And, you know, each devotee has their favorite aspect of Krishna to meditate upon. Each devotee has particular leelas of the Lord that they like to meditate on, particular forms of the Lord they like to meditate on, particular parts of the body of the Lord that they like to meditate on, and so forth. This is nicely explained by Sanatana Goswami in a commentary in Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 14. So I don't know if Kardama Muni particularly generally meditated on the Lord's navel, or if that's just at this time, but that was where he just went there. And this became his foreground meditation. Just like Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, it's explained that he had external, internal, and mixed consciousness. So this is what we call internal consciousness. Kardama Muni has stopped interacting with the world, and he has gone into, after all, he is a yogi. That's what he does. His main service as a yogi is dhyan. It is meditation. So he immediately goes to this meditation. And this reminds us of one of my favorite verses in the Bhagavatam about Bhishma when he's dying. That man who spoke on thousands of subjects with thousands of meanings and fought on thousands of battlefields with thousands of men, all of a sudden stopped speaking. As here, Kardama Muni stopped speaking. And at that point, Krishna, of course, was in front of him, so then he fixed his wide-open eyes on the personality of Godhead who was standing before him. Now, in this case, Krishna wasn't standing before Kardama Muni, so instead of fixing his wide-open eyes on the Lord, rather he fixed his internal vision on the Lord. And this is where he went as soon as there was no need to engage in the world. You know, for most of us, when there's no need to engage in the world, we go to our mental hopes and fears. Fears. Sochati kanchati. Generally, when we don't have a need to engage in the world, we go to, boy, there's lots of gyriks required in this temple. This is like...
It's occupational therapy.
Oh, is that what it is? Okay. So generally, as soon as we don't need to talk to somebody or think about something, we go to our sochati kanchati. We go to our hankering and lamenting. Oh, I wish I could have this. I'd like to get that. I'd like to buy this. I'd like to go there. I'd like to do this today. What's on my schedule for today? You know, and are lamenting. Oh, no, I said this thing the other day. I wrote that email. Oh, this person on my team, they did the wrong thing. Right? I was thinking about that this morning because I got an email from someone. I wrote comments on the wiki, and I'm like, oh, man, you're not supposed to write comments. You're supposed to change the text if you write comments, and I've got to take your comments, and I've got to change the text. Why don't you just change the text directly? Oh, boy, other people are going to do that, too. All right, I have to write an email to everybody in the group and tell them, don't comment, just make changes. Right? And that's where my mind's been going this morning. So we have this sort of places, right, that our mind goes with. Another place my mind went this morning is that this I'm buying tickets right now in America, and there are these airlines that are charging now $30 per flight for carry-on luggage. Like, oh my God. So you look at the price and you say, wow, this looks like a great price. Only $60. And then you see that they're going to charge you $30 or $35 for your carry-on bag, not even your check-in bag. I have to learn how to travel like Narada Muni. So my mind went to there this morning, you know. So my went to my anxieties, you understand? So as, you know, as soon as I'm not having some, as soon as I wasn't chanting my rounds, or as soon as I wasn't worshiping my Shilas, and that was where my mind went. It didn't go to lotus coming out of Krishna's navel. It went to, you know, my suitcases and my Shastric Advisory Council work for the GBC and those sort of places. And you can say that service, but it's not quite the same as meditating on Krishna's lotus navel. So someone like Karnava Muni, as soon as he's not interacting with the world, he goes there. Now what about when he is interacting with the world? Because Srila Prabhupada says here, the pure devotees are so absorbed in thought of Krishna, they have no other engagement. Although they may seem to think or act otherwise, they are always thinking of Krishna. So this means even when Kardama Muni is doing other things, for the last few verses he's been talking to Swayambhuva Manu, and he does, of course, mention the Lord in his previous verse, but we don't see that he's mentioning the Lord in every... Well, he did in this one, too. So let's see. If you look in all of his verses, so he talks about a Vedic system, but in that sentence he isn't. Two sentences there, and another two sentences there. No talk directly about Krishna. And so for five sentences, nothing about Krishna. Five, six, seven, nothing about Krishna. And there, on the tenth sentence, he talks about how he's going to become a Paramahamsa, as described by Lord Vishnu. And then finally at the end, his 11th and 12th sentence, again he talks about Vishnu. So we have, what, three sentences out of 12, I think? One-fourth of his sentences he was directly talking about Krishna, and the others he wasn't. He was describing Devahuti's beauty, for example, describing her qualifications. So you could say, well, that's pretty mundane. He's attracted by the beauty of this woman who he wants to marry and have children with. And that's, we could say that's kind of our definition of mundaneness, being attracted to the opposite sex with whom you want to produce children. And so Prabhupada says it may appear that they're thinking otherwise, that they're thinking about something else. That there was a conversation where Prabhupada was in Bengal with some devotees, and he said, the Bengali women are the most beautiful, with their black hair and their black eyes. And one of the devotees says, well, Krishna has dark hair and dark eyes too, Srila Prabhupada. And Prabhupada laughed. He said, even we're talking about Bengali, beautiful Bengali women, and immediately you're thinking of Krishna. So this description of how even when the devotee is in external consciousness, that they're still absorbed in Krishna is very nicely explained in the Madhurya Kadambani of Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, when he talks about the level of asakti, which is not even 100% pure devotion. Because although here Prabhupada is saying it appears that Kardama Muni was fully absorbed in Krishna consciousness, elsewhere he said he had some slight desire to enjoy household life. So he wasn't 100% seva. There was some slight desire on his part for material enjoyment. Of course, Kardama Muni's slight desire cannot be related to people like me. You know, if I'm going to talk about my material desires, it's not like there's some little slight desire in this ocean of Krishna consciousness. But the point is that Kardama Muni was not yet considered, according to the descriptions of Srila Prabhupada. He would not at this point be understood to be absolutely pure. Yet he was fully absorbed in Krishna consciousness, because this full absorption in Krishna consciousness comes before prema, even. It comes before prema. So when at least half of one's anarthas are destroyed, one comes to the platform of nishta, where one is basically fixed in goodness. So still there's 50% passion and ignorance, but it's not a disturbance anymore. It's like if you're cleaning a very room, once it's half cleaned, you can probably function in it. You're still cleaning, but you're starting to be able to do things in it. Does that make sense? You've reached a point where you're able to function in goodness, And the passion ignorance is no longer that operative in one's life. One is very rarely at the point of nista overcome by passion ignorance, and one is able to see it as something other than one's self. One's able to maintain, by 50% goodness, one's able to maintain a mode of goodness mentality the majority of the time. And that allows one in body, mind, and words to be absorbed in Krishna. Although that absorption in Krishna at that stage is still done by the will, although it's fairly easy will. So until you get to nishta, absorption in Krishna is done by the will, as Prabhupada says, as a hard struggle with determination. One thinks about Krishna, but not only by an action of will, but it's difficult. By nista, one thinks of Krishna still by the will, but it's easy, relatively speaking. It's easy. It doesn't require much effort. Then in ruchi, when one is feeling some taste in Krishna consciousness, so then obviously it's easier, but it's still by an act of will. And Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur explains that even at nista and ruchi, when the hard struggle for determination with determination has stopped, Prabhupada says, once you achieve nista, everything comes automatically one after another. So there's no more hard struggle with determination. But it's more like a plateau or a slightly inclined plateau. So until nista, it's like you're kind of going up a hill. I mean, it has some little troughs here and there. Krishna every once in a while gives you a break and makes everything very easy. But once you get to nista and ruchi, you're kind of going downhill, but it's still a plateau. You're not struggling, but nor is everything just flowing. But ashakti, at attachment, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says something very interesting happens. He says, at nista and ruchi, even when you're thinking of Krishna, your mind becomes diverted. You know, so you're thinking about Krishna's lotus navel, and then all of a sudden you remember about your navel, and you remember how you have a stomach ache. You know, you go to something mundane. You start thinking about Krishna's lotus feet, and then you think about how your shoes are wearing out, and you wonder if you could find a new pair for the same price. You know, you get diverted to something else. And you have to bring your mind back, as Krishna says in the 6th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. You bring your mind back to transcendence. Well, in Ashakti, just the reverse happens. That when you're thinking about or talking about something in the world, your mind naturally goes to Krishna. You know, somebody starts saying, oh, you know, there's these demoniac politicians right now running the world. And you go, yeah, just like there was Kamsa. And all the devotees were in hiding, and Krishna had to come and kill him. And, you know, just you naturally flow. It's like sometimes you're driving a vehicle where the steering wheel goes to a particular side, and you have to kind of work to keep it on that side. You know, so until ashakti, it's like that one has to make an effort to bring one's mind back to Krishna. And at ashakti, it just goes there. No matter what the discussion, no matter what the circumstance, you just find your consciousness flowing to Krishna. So again, there's kind of this, nista and ruchi are sort of this intermediate stage where it's not a struggle, but you're still making an effort, if that makes sense to everybody. I think if you compare it to driving a car, if any of you know how to drive a stick shift. So when you're first learning how to drive a stick shift, it's for most of us at least, It's a big struggle. You know, you're constantly stalling, especially if you try to start on a steep incline. You know, if you reach a stoplight on a steep hill and then you try to start in first gear, you inevitably will stall the car. And you have to put a lot of focus into how to coordinate the accelerator pedal and the clutch, right? Any of you who've driven a stick shift. And then it gets to a point where you're not driving smoothly. You're still thinking about it, but you're not stalling anymore. You know, you still have to give it some attention. It's not that you don't have to give it any attention. But it's more or less seamless, and you're not stalling. But then it gets to a point where you're just driving. You're driving, you're having a conversation, you're thinking about where you're going, and you're really not giving much attention to how your feet are coordinated on the pedals. So one who's at least at the level of ashakti, which is still in sadhana bhakti, ashakti is the highest level of sadhana bhakti, it's not even bhava, on that level, then your mind naturally flows to Krishna, even when you're doing other things. So Kardama Muni was at least at that point, where even when he's engaged with the world, there's a flow to Krishna always in his consciousness. He sees the relation of everything to Krishna, and it's an effortless flow. And we're going to be discussing this tomorrow night in Manashiksha when we talk about the stages of meditation. And when does meditation on Krishna become an effortless flow? So when one reaches that point, at least nista or ruchi, what to speak of, ashakti, then what happens is that internal attraction to Krishna, whether it's in the foreground or the background, starts manifesting through one's physical features. One's physical body starts to change, just like Rupa Goswami says that initiation changes the physical body, that one gets the body of a brahmana, because one's internal consciousness becomes absorbed in sattva-gun and ultimately in transcendence. And we see that this happens. Could I get some water? Is that possible? We see that this happens, that when a devotee is frankly absorbed in Krishna, both when they're in internal consciousness and when they're in external consciousness, that they become very attractive. Just like Srila Prabhupada was very attractive. Although you could say on an external level, he had the body of an older man, and, you know, nobody would take a photograph of his body and put it on the cover of a, you know, magazine as a model. Yes? If you looked at things from an objective physical perspective. But Srila Prabhupada was very attractive. And in fact, Srila Prabhupada was much more attractive than some, you know, highly paid model, who may have, you know, exactly the right shape, nose and eyes and so forth. Right, jaw, and stand in such a way. Because what's really attractive is Krishna. What's really attractive is not a particular physical configuration of this very ultimately... Very interesting. So, ultimately, this physical body, even if it's... Should have really asked you at the beginning. This is quite interesting. Remind me not to ask you for water again when I'm giving a class. It requires several laps back and forth here. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain.
There was water still sitting there since yesterday, so I had to wash it.
Oh, I see, I see, all right.
I didn't want to give yesterday's water.
Nobody was paying any attention to what I was saying. I was just like, what is Punya Sloka Prabhu doing going back and forth here? We're all programmed to be attached to movement, to be attracted by movement, just in case it's a tiger or something, or a snake. So we're all biologically programmed. And that's why TV and movies, they take what would normally be extremely boring stuff, and because they have a lot of fast movement, then people are captivated. If they didn't have any movement, everybody would just fall asleep and turn the thing off. Okay, so going back to that, if we're actually meditating on Krishna, we're very attractive. Because even this physical body, ultimately, what is it? It's not really attractive at all. If you took the components of this body, you know, if you just saw some skin lying around, right, or some hair, you know, you just see a pile of hair. So especially women spend so much money and time on their hair. I was once in an airport with a whole group of devotees. I forget where in the world it was, although I can see a picture of the airport. It was a very small airport. And, you know, the airports nowadays, they have screens with stuff on it because people can't live for more than, you know, 5 minutes without a screen. So they had some screen going, and it was some advertisement for some hair product. And there was some attractive woman with, I don't see how it could have been her real hair. I've hardly seen anyone in the world with hair like that. It was so thick and so shiny and such a beautiful color, advertising this, you know, hair product. And she was like swishing her hair around, you know. And all the men in our group just immediately looked at the floor. Everyone just instantly, as if they were a coordinated flock of birds or something. You know, it's like, one, two, three, look at the floor. And I thought, you know, if you just saw this woman's hair lying on the floor, if it wasn't attached to a body inhabited by a soul, it wouldn't be attractive at all. In fact, you'd go, can somebody clean up this hair that's lying on the floor? So really, the components of our body are very unattractive. You know, eyeballs, we just saw some eyeballs sitting on a plate in a surgical theater, you know, wouldn't be very attractive. So the most attractive parts of our body are actually not very attractive. So what really is attractive is the spirit. What makes this factually very unattractive body attractive is the presence of the spirit. And of course, the Supreme Spirit is the most attractive. I mean, we're very attracted ultimately by life. We're attracted even by little tiny forms of life. You know, we can be captivated by some little tiny insect or something like that. So what to speak of the whole? Like Krishna says, everything glorious and wondrous is but a spark of my splendor. So if we can find, you know, some ordinarily ugly body attractive when the soul is in it, imagine how attracted we could be to the Supreme Soul directly. And somebody who's meditating on the Supreme Soul, that Supreme Soul shines out through the body of that person. Just like we shine out through this body and are therefore attractive, isn't that? Right? Why was that woman's hair attractive? Because she was in the body. She, the soul, was in the body. It wasn't the hair. So just the fact that we, a little tiny, 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 tiny spark of Krishna are in this body, it can make the body attractive. We're attracted by a little squirrel, but we're not attracted by a dead squirrel body on the side of the road. So if we become a channel for the supremely attractive, then we also become attractive. And Kardamani, when he became so attractive, as soon as he went into this internal consciousness, that Devahuti, who's also a very great saintly person, she's not an ordinary person, she's immediately attracted. She's attracted to his Krishna consciousness. And of course, as I mentioned in the beginning, the irony is that those who become attractive that way, part of their being attractive that way is not having an interest in themselves being attractive. They want to act as a via media for Krishna. The great saintly persons, they're not really interested in attracting people to themselves. They're interested in acting as a vehicle to attract people to Krishna. I was just reading yesterday one devotee recounting how Prabhupada stopped devotees from chanting Jai Prabhupada, Jai Prabhupada, and said chant Hare Krishna. And something that I make a point of often in my preaching is that Srila Prabhupada did not put himself at the center of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Who did Prabhupada put at the center? Krishna, unambiguously so. I understand why we have, you know, a movement in preaching to put Prabhupada at the center. I understand that. And I think it has value. And I think it has some importance. But I do think we need to be careful that we're the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. If we really have Srila Prabhupada at the center, then we will have Krishna at the center.
Isn't it the teachings?
They mean Srila Prabhupada's teachings and they mean Srila Prabhupada's mood as a unifying factor for our Hare Krishna movement. That's what they mean. But we still have to be careful. You know, the only time I know of that Srila Prabhupada threw people out of the movement was when they started saying that he was God. So we do have to be careful that would not please Srila Prabhupada or Krishna. Doesn't please Lord Shiva when he's called God. He gets angry. He says, no, I'm a servant. You know, that is the mood that Srila Prabhupada had. And the fact that Prabhupada put Krishna at the center is one of the main reasons that our movement has continued. Because charismatic movements that have the charismatic leader at the center tend to fall apart as soon as that charismatic leader is no longer physically living on the planet. And Srila Prabhupada, being very aware of this, did not position himself in that way. And this is the mood of anybody who's preaching Krishna consciousness, anyone who's teaching Krishna consciousness. It should be get myself out of the center. Have myself be the conduit for the actual center. And of course, what happens is that Krishna likes to glorify his devotee. So Krishna pushes the devotee forward. But the devotee's mood is not like that. The devotee's mood is, it's all about Krishna. I'm simply in the background. I'm simply bringing the soul to Krishna. And that's like Prabhupada said, the guru is not your friend. He said, Krishna is your friend. The guru is your friend in this sense, that the guru brings you to Krishna, therefore the guru is your friend. So that was a lot of what makes a Krishna-conscious person attractive is their own lack of a desire to be attractive on their own. Even very physically attractive people, when their motive is to be attractive, that very motive is unattractive. That self-consciousness and that arrogance is very unattractive. Okay, questions, comments, corrections, additions, subtractions. And I want to thank you for your hospitality here. This is the last morning class I'll be giving. I'll be giving class tomorrow morning. But tonight we'll be going through Manashiksha, and tomorrow night also Manashiksha from 7 to 9. So any questions or comments on this verse in purport? Yes?
You're talking about qualities shining through devotees and qualities.
Yes. Yes, yes. We've seen that with other devotees too. I've seen other devotees too. Where, you know, they're just, wow.
And we see some pictures of Srila Prabhupada's line.
Yes.
Uplifting and transporting. Have you ever seen him in person when he has those big eyes?
No. No.
Hear stories about that? Because somebody gave me a picture of Prabhupada with his eyes going really big.
No, no. I mean, the first time we met with Srila Prabhupada in his room for a darshan, Prabhupada was particularly in a smiling, jovial mood. And the content of the conversation wasn't that deep from my perspective. But when we left, my father looked at me and said, "Now I know why you're here. This is a genuine holy man." And to this day, I've never been able to figure out how he came to that conclusion on the basis of that one meeting. I never asked him. I figured if he thinks that way, leave it alone. But I didn't ask him, you know, how on the basis of that one half an hour meeting with Srila Prabhupada did you conclude that he was a holy man? Yes?
If not everyone has got many questions, are you able to share some pastime with Srila Prabhupada?
I just did.
Yeah, I just did. No. Then we'll be here until 10 o'clock and we have a lot to do today. No. Yes?
You were discussing in the Manashiksha class the other night about how devotee can be a little bit artificial to want to withdraw and your own chant and all that kind of thing. But sometimes it seems with all the activities that go on in ISKCON, sometimes it seems very distracting from hearing and chanting because there's so much to do and. You know, sometimes it may not run like that as efficiently as you'd like it or whatever. Mm. You end up, you know, using a lot of energy that you'd kind of sometimes prefer to be using for more direct hearing and chanting.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a devotee that I'm talking to who's struggling to chant and has stopped chanting for a while, though. It's an initiated devotee. And when I was visiting there recently, we were chanting together and the devotee said, "Oh, now I've started chanting again." So I just wrote to this person who's just gone back to work after a break from work. "So are you still chanting?" "Well, no, because, you know, I leave at 5 in the morning and I don't get back till 8 at night and it's go, 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 go all day, but I love my work." And I thought, you know, do you really want to put yourself in a position like that, even if you love your work, where you're working that many hours and you don't have time? You know, how much time you're going to have with your family, even. What to speak of how much time you're going to spend with Krishna. So, you know, I often like to... What?
Life's short.
Well, you know what Krishna will do if you do that kind of thing. If you say you want to chant and you want to hear, and you're running around like that, you know what Krishna does. He knocks your feet out from under you. There's a story I read. I wish I could find it. I really wish I could find it. I haven't been able to find it. It was one of those things I should have copied and kept it. It was about this Christian minister who was working 100 hours a week in ministry, as a minister. And he was going to have a fairly routine minor operation, I think, for a hernia. It wasn't a major operation. And they were going to do what they call laparoscopy, where they make a very small incision and they just thread this little thing up to fix the thing. So he felt a lot of fear about the operation, although he couldn't understand why. In the middle of the operation, somehow the little thing slipped, and it cut through a major blood vessel in his abdomen, and he was bleeding internally to death. And because they had just made a small incision, they couldn't see what was going on. So he left his body, and he was hovering in the operation theater. And at first he didn't know that it was his body, which is very common when people have this kind of experience. So at first he thought, oh, that guy there on the table looks like he's really in bad shape. And after all, he came to understand, oh, that's my body there. And then he said he heard a voice, which he just somehow knew was the voice of God. He said, immediately I knew this was the voice of God. And I think his name was Steve. And this voice said to him, Steve, how many hours do you work a week? And he said he was overcome that God was speaking to him and that God knew his name. He started out the story by saying that as a minister, people often told him that God speaks to them, and he was always very skeptical. He said after this experience, he wasn't so skeptical anymore. And then he said, about 100 hours a week, Lord. And then the voice said, what are the names of your children's friends? And he couldn't answer. And then the voice said, stop being a rabbit, be a turtle. And meanwhile, he's watching his body on the operating table and, you know, his... flatlining, and the doctors do an emergency major incision and clamp everything and rescue him, and he goes back into his body. And then he's months in the hospital recovering. And so he wrote that I started my turtle life in the hospital by force to spend these months recovering. He said, nowadays I only work 36 hours a week. I know the names of my children's friend. And I make sure that I spend quality time with the Lord. I'm not just running around doing his business. When I was growing up, my father was the CEO of a multinational company, and he was also a temple president, not a Hare Krishna temple, a Jewish temple. But it was a big temple. I mean, it was in New York City, and there were hundreds of members of the temple. So he was a very busy man. But from when I was 2 years old, until I went to university when I was 17. He spent 2 hours every morning being with me. And my mother didn't. She was up late watching TV, and my father wasn't a TV person. My mother would stay up late watching TV, and she wouldn't wake up till about 10 in the morning. So I actually didn't see my mother much. And she was often, when I came home from school, she was often out. She ran two or three international Jewish charities. She was a very active person. So I didn't have that much of a close relationship with my mother. We had, you know, nannies and stuff that were taking care of me. But with my father, I spent those 2 hours every morning with my father. And he would wake up at about 5 in the morning. So he would tell me stories. And I remember we had two dolls. They were both named Ginger. And his Ginger doll would play with my Ginger doll and would tell me stories and teach me about different morals and ethics. And I remember that he also had a Polaroid camera, which I was fascinated by because it would develop the pictures right there. And so we would take different pictures, and I had a little pet turtle, and he would take pictures of my turtle, and he helped me make a little book about my turtle, and he'd read me books.
A real turtle?
He had a real turtle when I was very small. And then he would make me breakfast. I mean, he never cooked anything in his life. That was the days in which the women did all the cooking. And of course, my mother didn't cook either. She had a servant. But anyway, my father didn't cook. But he would toast the bread, and he would always make me fresh squeezed orange juice. You see these kind of orange juice makers in India sometimes on the cart. They're hand operated. They're kind of a tall thing, and you pull down on the lever. So he would always make me fresh orange juice. To this day, I don't like canned or boxed orange juice. He gave me a real taste for something fresh. And he always used honey instead of sugar. He put honey on my cereal or honey on my toast. And we spent about 2 hours together every single morning. And, you know, we never did anything amazing during that time. But we just spent the time together. And because of that, we always had a very, very close relationship. And anything my father asked of me, I would do for him. I would have died for him. I mean, when I told my father I was joining the Hare Krishna movement, he said, I'm so glad you're looking for God. He said, I wish you could have done it in Judaism, but that's not what's important. What's important is you're looking for God. My mother became hysterical. What are you doing? It took my mother 10 years to accept that I had actually joined the Hare Krishna movement. But if my father had been against it, I don't know if I could have joined. I think it would have been too difficult for me. From the time I was 3, he said, don't ever smoke. And that was, there was no cancer warnings on cigarette packs in those days. You know, cigarettes were advertised on television. When I got to secondary school and high school, probably 90% of the kids smoked. I'm sure I would have smoked. And I didn't smoke not because I was afraid of cancer. You know, when you're 14, 15, you're not afraid of cancer. You figure you're immortal. But, you know, I didn't smoke because it would have broken my father's heart. So our sadhana is like that. Our sadhana is our time with Krishna. We can run around all day doing things for Krishna, but we also need time with Krishna. If we don't have time with Krishna, then we're not going to have Krishna in the background always while we're running around doing things for him. We're going to forget who we're doing it for. And it's going to become all about ego and politics, and it's going to become something more or less mundane. All of our running around busy with this and that and the other thing. You know, if you're working for your family but you never spend any time with your family, what is the point? You know, you find some people, they work in a distant country and they see their family every 4 years. There's a lot of people like this in Dubai and Abu Dhabi and places like that. Prabhupada talked about a child he knew, 3-4 years old when he was in India, that his father left early in the morning and came back late at night. And one day the father was there on a weekend, and the boy said, Prabhupada said he saw this personally, the boy said to his mother, who is that man? You know, I don't want Krishna to say, who is that person? Who is that person? Just that the guy was working for his kid and sending money to his wife to pay for the kid, and the kid said, who is that man? We don't want Krishna to say, who is that person? I don't know them. They never hang out with me. They never spend time with me. So in the ultimate sense, we each have to fly our own plane. If you're willing to work hard 24/7, there are authorities in the movement who will engage you in hard work 24/7. And they will probably not say, Prabhu, when are you finding time to chant? Yeah, I mean, it's very rare. I was just staying with Saki Roy and his family in Brisbane, and he said that to me. He said, practically nobody ever asked me, how's your japa, Prabhu? And this is also my experience in the Hare Krishna movement. There's very, very few people who ask me, very rare, that anybody will say, how is your sadhana? You know, that's a rare thing. But people are happy to engage me, and you know, I was once, this was actually in Melbourne, this was several years ago. So I was meeting a couple who were engaged. Now they're married with a child, but at this point they were engaged and married. And the woman was one of these, you know, super woman kind of people. One time she said that she would cook for my Govardhan Srila, and in 2 hours, she had made a 25-prep feast. So that kind of person. And so her fiancé was telling me, he said, you know, I'm telling her she has to slow down. She can't overwork herself. So he's going on and on about how he's protecting his fiancé. Right? So then he says to me, so Armila, we've gone over your schedule. I said, okay, but I really try to limit myself to 2 programs in a day. I very rarely do 3. 1 or 2. And then he starts pressuring me to do 3. And I said, look, your own fiancé, you're trying to protect her from burning herself out, and then you want me to burn myself out. So there will be, you know, we've got to really fly our own plane. We want to be here for the long haul, and we want to go back to Godhead, and we want to develop our relationship with Krishna. And ultimately, we have to be able to say, look, this is what I need for my survival. This is what I need for my spiritual survival and my spiritual nourishment, and that's got to be prioritized. To quote Stephen Covey, always have, you know, have the main thing making the main thing the main thing. The main thing is to make the main thing the main thing.
It helps to have good role models around us. You know, sometimes we don't see that.
Yes. Well, you know, if you want that, Krishna will manifest good role models for you. I've also find that if you want to do that because Krishna wants to do that, he will arrange it without having you die on the operating table. You know, dying on the operating table is you probably haven't listened when he was talking to you nicely, that he has to get real dramatic and pull you out of your body so you can hear him. You know, I always give the example, when Krishna wants to move his cows from one place to another, how does he do it?
Plays his flute.
Plays his flute. How else does he do it? What else?
Calls their names.
And what else does he have? He has his buffalo horn. What else? Some things he carries around with him. Ropes. And what else? Also carries something else. A stick. So he's got names, flute, buffalo horn, rope, stick, probably in that order. And the same with us. First he's going to quietly call our name. Hey! I'm over here. Then he'll play a flute. Then he'll blow a buffalo horn. Then he'll get out a rope. And finally he'll get out a stick. So don't wait till he gets out the stick. At least at the flute, if you can't hear the name. come when it's soft. Because Krishna doesn't like to get heavy. It's like we don't. If we're normal, mentally balanced people, we don't like to get heavy with other people. We would like other people to do the right thing when we just hint at it. That's what we'd like. Yes? We don't even like directly asking. Isn't that correct? We like just being able to say, you know, I'm feeling kind of tired right now. And we want the other person to immediately respond with, okay, I'll talk to you later. We don't even like to get, excuse me, I really can't talk to you anymore. I'm exhausted. I need to go to bed. We don't like being so direct, is it? So Krishna feels the same way. There's a nice purport where Prabhupada writes how, I think it's in the third canto, that Krishna regret, or first or third, I can't remember, where Krishna regretfully punishes the demons. He doesn't like it. He doesn't enjoy it. What to speak of Krishna punishing his own devotees? He really doesn't like it. So, you know, to look honestly at our lives. You know, what's the main reason that Srila Prabhupada engaged us in running around doing all these things? Because we're already very much in the mode of passion, and if we don't use that in Krishna's service, we'll use it for something else. Not because it's necessary for our Krishna consciousness, and not even because it's necessary for preaching, frankly. I have a couple nice letters. And Prabhupada said, you know, you don't have to accomplish all these things. You can just, even if you just help one person in a day. Or another place where, I don't have these memorized, unfortunately, but another place where he says that our activities are simply a way for us to put the philosophy into practical action. Just so we can see the philosophy in action. Now, that doesn't mean we should be lazy. Although, I was just reading this to you, right? How in the nectar devotion, there's a lazy bhava. So laziness is one of the anubhavas of those who are in ecstatic love. So it said there can be laziness from self-satisfaction. And the example given was the brahmanas, that they told Nanda Maharaj, we're not going to circumambulate Govardhan Hill. We'd rather just stay here and bless people. And then there was a laziness due to excessive labor. And that was when one of the cowherd boys was challenging Subala to a fight. And he didn't want to fight. And Krishna says, oh, Subala's already been working so hard. Now he just leave him alone. Let him be lazy. So I was sharing that with a friend, and she wrote back. She said, so I'm going to start my own Vaishnav sect, the sect of the lazy bhava. our only scripture is going to be this one quote from the Nectar of Devotion. That will be our sole scripture. And being very self-satisfied, I am simply going to bless everyone. And being very fatigued by hard labor, I'm not going to do anything else to start my sect of lazy bhava. So my point in bringing this up is unless you're actually in ecstatic love and experiencing laziness as a bhava, then we shouldn't use our chanting and hearing as an excuse to be lazy in Prabhupada's mission. So therefore we have to be intelligent. Because if we do still have passion going through our body, we better go out and do something with it. If you just try to sit and chant and read and you don't use whatever mode of passion is there in the mission, you'll use it for Maya. So one has to know oneself clearly. You know, we have to spend quality time with Krishna. We can't be running around all the time such that we never spend any time with Krishna. At the same time, if when we spend time with Krishna, we simply, as Prabhupada said, meditate on women and money, then better get out there and do some work also. And each of us has to come to how much do we run around and how much are we engaged in. And that may change over our lifespan. How much we run around when we're 18 may be a little different as to how much we're running around when we're 68 also. Now that may be something that we have to adjust. Yes?
You know, as you're speaking, it's like something pulling, trying to, you know, to get this established, but underneath it there's that feeling that the temple's falling apart, there's no direction. You know, what are we going to do?
Well, if that's pulling you, then act on it. But make sure that you have some time you're spending with Krishna. Don't just run around for Krishna all the time. Spend some time with Krishna. You should spend quality time with Krishna every day. Otherwise, he'll be sad. He loves you. I was sad my mother didn't spend time with me every day. It was a sadness for me. You know, what's the main complaint that a housewife has about her working husband? He doesn't spend enough time with me. And it's interesting that the men usually take that as a criticism, but actually it's saying, I really like you. What's the point of being married to you if I never get to be with you? I mean, he should take it as a compliment, though generally they don't. But Krishna says he loves us. He wants to be with us. Prabhupada said he's 10 times more anxious to be with us than we are to be with him. And he's saying, why don't you spend some time with me? I'm running around doing things for you. Okay, very nice. Why don't you spend some time with me?
I see. It's a strange thing, isn't it? It's kind of...
Yeah. There's an instance in Rupa Goswami's Ujjwala Nimamani, which is discussed to some extent in the Madhulila of the Chaitanya Charitamrita about the... different kinds of separation between Krishna and the gopis. And one kind of separation is due to man, or anger. So almost always the man is from the side of the gopis. You find the women are getting angry at the men, but the men aren't getting angry at the women. In the spiritual world, Krishna doesn't get angry with the gopis. But Krishna has some slight, sometimes slight anger. One is without cause. That sometimes like Radha and Krishna are arguing for no reason. But there's also Krishna has a slight anger due to cause. When the gopis are angry due to cause, it's almost always because of a rival. Just like we were hearing this morning in the Nectar Devotion, one of the funniest exchanges, how Krishna is very intelligent. And how Radharani says, so where were you? You know, Krishna didn't show up all night. And finally he shows up in the morning and she says, where are your clothes? But the word for clothes also means residence and fragrance. So Krishna says, oh, my residence is in your beautiful eyes. She said, I didn't ask you about your residence. I asked you about your clothes. He says, I have this fragrance just to be associated with your body. So then she gives up. She tries another tact. And she says, where did you spend the night? And he takes the words and mixes them another way. And he said, night couldn't kidnap me. And then she's happy and she's not angry anymore. Even though he was out away all night and he didn't even have all his clothes. So, you know, Krishna is... The anger from the gopis toward Krishna is usually because of that. He's not there. He's with some rival. But there were instances where Krishna was a little annoyed with one of the gopis. And in one of them, it's because she was taking too long to pick flowers for him. Why are you spending so long picking flowers? You're supposed to be here with me. So, you know, if we have that, I got to do this for the temple and I got to do that, then do it. Use that. Don't repress it. Use it. But remember to spend time with the person for whom you're doing it for. Don't forget about him. Don't be so busy doing things for him and talking about him that you're never talking to him. And you're never spending time with him. You know, I mean, I know a devotee who was working three jobs. I said, Prabhupada, why are you working three jobs? And he was maintaining like three properties. He said, I'm doing it for my family. I said, but you never see your family. And he ended up losing his family. They, you know. His wife left him. His kids don't really like him. I mean, they never had a relationship. They weren't grateful for the three houses on the three properties and the $200,000 in the bank. They didn't care. They wanted him. So, but there's also a lot of work that Krishna wants us to do in this world. He's interested in that. He's not interested in that. And Prabhupada wants us to be preachers, and Mahaprabhu, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, wants us to be preachers, so we better get out there and work. Don't get into the lazy bhava unless you're already in Krishna Prema. Don't start your own lazy bhava society. But don't forget to spend time with Krishna. And make it quality time, and make it quality time every day.
Krishna. You can't have another
Srimad Bhagavatam
class tomorrow morning to spend time with Krishna?
No, sorry. Okay, should we end here? Srimad Prabhupada ki jai.